Did you hear about the guy who went into the Catholic Church and he hadn't been there before, and he came out, he says, "That's the strangest place I ever saw in my life." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well," he said, "there's one guy standing up there in the front, and he's chanting, and he's saying, 'I can beat anyone in the house playing dominoes.'" And the other guy says, "The hell you can." Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Campbell, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm the guy who replaced Larry Kay. I am so glad to get my name back. You know, for the last 2.5 days around here, they have been calling me Fred. I went up to somebody last night, and they said, "Hi, Fred." And somebody else says, "No, that F-R means father." And this other person looked at me strangely, you know, and said, "So? How many children do you have?" Fred, you know, I thought last night as I was going to sleep, you know, what would happen if my last name was Ootcake? Then you'd put the F-R in front of that and you'd have a real name, wouldn't you? Fruitcake. Oh, jeez. I've been listening to all of you speakers that have gone an hour and a half, hour and 15 minutes, telling your story. Up at my church, which is just up the road here, St. Simon's Episcopal Church, there's a podium we have back in the parish hall, and it has this thing written on it from the Bishop of Oxford, and it says, "Preach the gospel, but only for 20 minutes. Now, I don't know if I can go longer than that. I really don't know if I can make it or not. Well, let's see. What do I want to tell you today? I want to tell you that I'm scared out of my damn mind. That's what I want to tell you. First of all, I went to McDonald's last night. My wife's out of town taking our older daughter to check out colleges up in Birmingham. And so my younger daughter, who's 14, named Joanna, she and I went out to a high-class meal last night at McDonald's, and she says, "What's the matter, Dad?" And I said, "I'm scared." And she says, "Well, I don't know why you're scared, Dad. You lecture to us all the time, and you don't know what you're talking about." And says, "You're going down there tomorrow to talk to a bunch of drunks, and you know a lot about that." Okay. Somebody said that they looked for a speaker on Sunday morning who had some experience in the spiritual side of the program. And then one of my erstwhile friends said, "And then they went and found Father Ed." Incidentally, Clancy, how in the hell can you be a Protestant with a name like that? Swedish Lutheran. Never heard anything like that. I'm going to tell you before I get started about a couple of spiritual experiences. This is a spiritual experience. Joyce, you'll understand this. I was 45 years old, and I fell in love with a young lady who was 26 years old. She lived in Citronelle, Alabama, and you can't hardly get there from here. She was 26, I was 45, and I went to meet her parents. They are strong, strong Southern Baptists, okay? They don't drink, and they don't smoke, and they don't dance. And I show up, and I am 45 years old. I am divorced. This is 1973, and 5 years before I found my way into this program. I am divorced, 45, I drink, I smoke, and I wore this damn collar, which meant I was an Episcopalian, and Episcopalians in Citronelle, Alabama are next to Catholics, and none of them are any good. And that was a spiritual experience. Another spiritual experience, for those of you, I'm from Fort Walton Beach now, but, you know, a spiritual experience here, and you guys ought to try it sometime. Go, if you go up where my church is and decide you want to get something to eat over at Whataburger, try crossing 98. That's a spiritual experience. I thought that this is Sunday morning, and I certainly ought to share a piece of scripture with you before I begin, because that's what, you know, that's what clergy are supposed to do. I want you, when you go back home, to get a revised standard version of the Bible, and I want you to go to the Psalms, and I want you to look up Psalm 50, verse 9. Psalm 50, verse 9. It reads, I will accept no bull from your house. Okay. Oh, Lord. Clancy, I'm one of those 28-day wonders that you talked about last night. I always thought of myself as a high-class drunk. And I went through that 28-day program because I didn't like AA, and I didn't figure I was going to have anything to do with it when I went in there. And just like you said, while I was there, being the compulsive person that I am, I decided to work all 12 steps before I left. And I rattled through the whole cotton-picking thing. I did step 4 in about 25 minutes. And I got out of there, and I went back to Cullman, Alabama, and I got into a group, and I stayed in that group for about 6 months, and then I moved to Arlington, Virginia, and I had a church up there, or Manassas, Virginia, and I was working with drunks every day, and I said, I don't need to go to meetings. And I talked the program and worked it hard for about 11 and a half years in my office. Showed up at a meeting about once a year to get the chip. And then, somewhere back about June of this last year, St. Simon's is full of drunks. Oh, God, we got a lot of them. And they're great and wonderful people. And I was in one of my down times, and I wasn't aware of the fact that it was all resentments going on that I'd built up over 11 and a half years of not going to meetings. And one of my dear friends, who is now one of my sponsors, came in, and I was sort of, he said, how are you, Ed? I said, I'm okay. I said, I'm kind of down, you know. Nothing seems to be going quite right. And he said, why don't you go to a meeting? And I said, okay, I think I'll do that. And I went to a meeting of the Miracle Group here at St. Mary's. I invaded your territory, Jack. They still don't know. I don't wear this thing there, because if they knew who I was, they'd kick me out. But I went there, and I want to tell you that while I have 13 plus years of not having had a drink, I want you to know I am very new in the program. And I am excited out of my mind at what I am learning every single day. And so I don't stand up here as an old head. I stand up here as the new kid on the block. And I just am so excited about the growth that
that I'm experiencing in this wonderful program. I'll tell you about another. You know, I too was a sports writer, Clancy, for 12 years before I went bad and got into this business. And I was a golfer, and I am a golfer. And at one time I thought that I would not do this, what I'm doing now, but that I would become a golf pro. And every year the golf writers had their national championship at the Dunes Golf and Beach Club in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. I at that time was sports editor of the News and Courier in Charleston, South Carolina. And I would go up to this tournament every year, won it a couple of times. You know how you won the tournament? Fantastic experience. The way you won the tournament was to complete 18 holes standing. Now, I'm serious about that. I mean, hell, I won it with an 83. I won, shot an 83 one year, and won by 15 shots. I didn't know how to play golf without a fifth of whiskey in the bag. Did not know how to do that. Had a wonderful time, though, I thought. I thought I was having a great time. Well, let me tell you a little bit about how it was for me and what happened and where I am now. Incidentally, I'm up to my usual. I am having my usual run of luck. I bought my 5 tickets yesterday. And I want you to know that there are 50 numbers on the lottery every week, right? I have 5 tickets here. That's 30 numbers, right? Not one. Not one number. And I couldn't even win in here last night. Leo kept hauling up red and orange and yellow, and he never picked the blue tickets. And if he did, they were 400 away from me. Bad news. I grew up in Arlington, Virginia. My dad is a lawyer in Washington, D.C. He is 92 years old. He's about to be 93. He still works every day. My stepmother, my own mother died when I was about 7. My stepmother is about to be 90 years old, and she was the founder of a educational television station in Washington, D.C., WETA. Still goes to work, works 8 hours a day. That's the kind of family I come from. And my name is Edmund Douglas Campbell, Jr. And I want to tell you all right now, when you name your kids, don't name them after you. That is the damnedest thing that you can do to your children, is to name them after you, because either they're sorry they got your name because they don't want to live up to what you are, or you try to live up to what your parents are and you don't make it. And God, I spent a lot of years trying to do that, to try and be like my dad. I even thought I wanted to go to law school. I went to Washington and Lee University, and I thought I'd like to be like my dad, be a lawyer. So I went to him after about the 3rd year in school, and I said, "Dad, I think I'm going to go to law school." And he says, "You haven't got the analytical mind for it." He is right, I didn't. So I became a sports writer. Didn't happen to have an analytical mind for that, to be messing around with jocks all day. So, but I should have known all along that I was an addicted person. I didn't know that. Everything I did in spades. I was, am, will always be a sports nut. You know, There is not a thing that you can put on the television that I don't love to watch in the way of sports. They can play snooker, you know, they can play badminton, anything. I will sit there glued and watch it for hours and hours and hours. I'm an addictive person. I have always been addicted. I'm addicted to people. I'm addicted to women. Oh, God. And I most certainly was addicted to alcohol. No question about that. Anyway, I grew up in Arlington, Virginia, with this very successful kind of family. And I was the firstborn. And I never did quite measure up in my own eyes, anyway. And I'm not sure I measured up in their eyes either. You know, I didn't have a very good self-image. My dad would come to me every once in a while. I can remember this. I was 14 or 15 years old, and he would come to me every once in a while, and he would say, "Ed, I want to talk to you." And you know what my first reaction was? My gut would clutch up like this, and I'm not sure I knew the words at that time. I know them now. I would think, oh, shit. What have I done wrong? To this day, my dad is 92. I am about to be 65 years old. You want to know about control? He can call me on the telephone from Arlington, Virginia, and say, "Ed, I want to talk to you," and my gut does the same thing to this very day. Crazy. Grew up in Arlington, Virginia, went to high school in Washington, D.C. I went to Western High School, right close to Georgetown University, which you mackerel snappers are familiar with. And there's where I first learned to drink. Western High School, incidentally, now is no longer there. It's now the Duke Ellington School of the Arts. But anyway, there was a little place that you passed when I walked from school down to Key Bridge to catch the bus home. It was a place called Teehan's. No longer there, I don't think. But that was where I had my first drink at age 16. And it was a wonderful experience. I had my first drink there, and my second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth. TN's was located on the top of a hill. To get down to Key Bridge, you down past the old car barn, there was a series of steps, about 250 of them. I walked about three of them. And fell the other 247 and thought it was funny as hell. Jeez, it's crazy. And like I said, I was a high class drunk. I learned in where I grew up in Virginia, you were supposed to drink. My mom and dad didn't drink that much, but I was around people, and drinking was the thing that you did, and what you were supposed to learn to do was to drink like a gentleman. Okay? And I learned how to do that. I learned how to drink like a gentleman. You know what that meant? You wore a coat and a tie. Okay? You wore a coat and a tie and a nice shirt. And you drank all that you could drink, and to be a gentleman, you just didn't throw up on anybody. You know, if you were going to throw up, you threw up somewhere else, outside. And then I went to Washington and Lee University, and by damn, they really taught you how to drink there, like a gentleman. And I learned it well. I learned it extremely well. And then I graduated in 1950. Oh, incidentally, right after high school, I'd had a spell in the United States Navy, right toward the end of World War II, and I further enhanced my drinking career there. I fought the Battle of the Patuxent River and would go over to Solomon Island, which was across the way from Patuxent, and this was hard times in terms of booze. You know, some of the best stuff that you could get at that time was Southern Comfort. Sickening, sweet stuff, awful. But, you know, when you wanted to have it, you did what you did. And I was so glad when the war was over and we could get back to good booze. Anyway, when I graduated from college, I went to Charleston, South Carolina, and became a newspaper man. I had a college degree, and I went to work for $30 a week as an obit writer for the News and Courier in Charleston. And of course, you have seen all the Class B movies about what newspaper men are like. You know that they wear a hat on the back of their head and collars open and the ties down here and their feet are up on the desk and there's a fifth of whiskey in the drawer. Damned accurate. Very accurate. Of course, I worked on a morning newspaper, so I never got to see the sun rise or set. Okay, I went to work at 3 o'clock, 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon and worked until about 1 or 2 in the morning, and then we went down to the Anchor Bar and Grill, which was about 65 yards away, drank until 3 or 4 or 5 in the morning, got home before the sun rose, fell into bed, went to sleep, got up at noon, went to work. Did that for 12 years. Became a pro. Really became a pro at that time. Absolutely a professional drinker. I was just wonderful at it. I got married in 1951. I always did what my dad said. My dad came down to visit one day, and he saw this girl that I happened to have a date with this time. I'd only dated her twice, and he looked at that girl, and he said, "You ought to marry that girl." I always did what my dad said. I married that girl. Had 21 miserable years. You know, but that wasn't her fault. That wasn't her fault. That was me and the booze and all that had done to the insanity that was already set into my life at that particular point. I got married thinking that all you had to do was walk down the aisle and all this good stuff is going to happen to you. Good sex, good everything. I wasn't going to have to do anything at all. It took me 21 years to find out that if you're going to be married, it's the hardest work you're ever going to do in your life. That's harder than staying sober. Okay? It really is. That's the hardest work you ever do in your life. But anyway, I married this girl because my dad said so. And I worked in the newspaper business for 12 years. I had a wonderful time. I loved it. God, I loved it. I still love it. You know, I don't know why I got into doing what I do now. But I loved being a writer. And I loved being with all of those people, because I got to be with the Arnold Palmers and the Sam Sneeds. I was watching the old guys play the Skins game the other day, and you know, I was with all of those guys, drank with them, had a wonderful time with those guys. And I got to be a member of a country club and didn't have to pay a daggone thing. I got to hobnob with all of the great people. Didn't cost me anything. I got to live high on my $50 or $60 a week. Wonderful experience. But you see, that just sort of continued to feed my insanity of thinking that, and of course the booze helped this, because every time I drank, I felt that I was more than I was. You know, that I was better than I was. When I wasn't drinking, which wasn't very often, I didn't like that. I kind of had to look at who I was, and I didn't particularly like that. But when I had that drink of booze, man, just like all of you who have spoken before said, you know, I felt on top of the world. There wasn't a thing in this world I couldn't do. Nothing that I couldn't do. And then, you know, I part as the booze continued to progress for me, I said that I needed something different in my life. The newspaper was kind of forcing me to make some decisions because by that time I'd gotten mixed up in the church. It was a terrible time in the church in South Carolina at that particular time. The John Birch Society was going bananas, and they were calling me a communist every day, and you know, I don't know why. I was a columnist, but whatever I wrote, they didn't like. And so anything they didn't like, they thought that meant that you were a communist. So I was called into my managing editor's office one day, and he said, "Ed, you really kind of need to make a decision about whether you want to work for us or you want to work for the church." And so I went down to see our bishop, and I said, "Bishop, I think I'd like to go to the seminary." And he looked at me, he's a wonderful guy, and you'd never think that he would say anything like this because he was just pure, wonderful gentleman. And he turned to me and he said, "Boy," he said, "get your ass back on down to that newspaper because God knows they could use a few Christians down there." And so I went back and I worked another year. And then he finally let me go to the seminary. And I loved it. I loved the seminary. You know why? Because they drank. We didn't drink as much whiskey in the seminary. Couldn't afford it. But you could go across into Georgetown and you could pick up a gallon of Gallo's sherry for about $2.25. Yeah. Oh, jeez, I loved it. See, that's a wonderful thing about the Episcopal. That's why they call us Whiskeyparians. What do they call you guys? Well, I know what they call you, but I'm not going to tell you. So I went to the seminary, and, you know, I told somebody at a meeting the other night, I know that a lot of folks look at me when I'm wearing this collar, and they say, "Oh, yeah, there he is. He was a drunken old newspaper man, and then he finally found the Lord and went into the ministry." Not this kid. Not this kid. I went into the ministry as a drunk, and I stayed in the ministry for 17, 18 years as a drunk, and then found you guys, and am still in the process of getting to know the Lord. And I guess that's going to be a lifetime process, just like it's a lifetime process of learning how to be sober one day at a time. So, I got out of the seminary, and it was a strange thing about me. I fashioned myself as one of these guys who could go into a place and I could whip them up. I could get them excited about all kinds of things. But I found that I got kind of tired of that after 2 or 3 years. And you know, I felt like maybe it was time to move on and whip some more people up. You know what I was doing, don't you? God, I was taking geographical cures every 2.5 years. That's what I was doing. And so I went to a little place in Allendale, South Carolina, and I lasted there about 2.5 years. And then I went to Birmingham, Alabama, and I was in a place for about 2.5 years. And then I went to another place in Birmingham, and I was there about 2 years and had 2 or 3 affairs and then a divorce. Still didn't learn anything. Still didn't learn anything. Well, I'll tell you something. You know, when I was in my first parish back in, this was about 1967 or 8, I guess it was. I was in Allendale, South Carolina. And I fashioned myself a musician, among other things. I could play the guitar, 4 chords. That's all I can still play. But I also fashioned myself as a songwriter. And this is back in the late 60s and early 70s, made for a people like me this time was. Oh, man. I mean, it was a very permissive time. You could do anything. And it was a wonderful time for me, and I thought that I would write songs. I just ran across last night one of those songs that I wrote. And you want to hear the cry? You want to hear the cry of the alcoholic? Listen to this song, the words. I will not sing it for you. It was called Tired of Pretending. I have to read it because I can't even remember what I wrote way back then. But I said, tired of pretending to be what I'm not, tired of pretending to have what I have not. I want to love and be loved, and I want to be free, but most of all, Lord, I want to be free to be me. And I'm tired of pretending and trying to hide, tired of the selfishness, tired of the pride. I want to love and be loved, and I want to be free, but most of all, Lord, I want to be free to be me. Tired of pretending the world's made for me, tired of the blindness, because I want to see. I want to love and be loved, and I want to be free, but most of all, Lord, I want to be free to be me. Now, if that isn't a drunk's cry for help, I don't know what it is. That was 10 years before I found you guys. 10 years. Crazy. And it went on, and it went on from there. That first marriage ended. I was blessed. I really was blessed in my life. In our particular church, we have bishops. And bishops can decide whether you live or die, you know. And I had a bishop who really did love me. He was a good friend. We were drinking buddies, is what we were, as a matter of fact. I can remember that his birthday is about the same as mine, and my mother and dad were coming down to see us one time, and the bishop and I were sitting in my den drinking martinis. And I can remember that when I went in sloshed fashion and picked up my mom and dad from the airport and brought them to the house, we were there, both of us sloshed, the bishop and me, and they were they couldn't quite understand that, how a bishop could do that. But anyway, he was a great guy, and when I went through my divorce, he decided that I needed not to be thrown out. You know, he very easily could have tossed me out on my derriere, but he didn't, and I will forever be grateful to my higher power for that. And so he said, you need to take a little sabbatical, boy. And so I did, and I went to work as a public relations director for the United Appeal in Birmingham, and could use all of my former talents as a writer and other stuff. And I did that for a year, and he let me supply at some other churches, and I did that. And while I was at the United Appeal, I met Sheila. Sheila was the executive secretary for the Boy Scouts of America, and they were housed in the same building there in Birmingham. And I saw this cute gal with these long, good-looking legs, and I asked her for a date, and she said, "No, I'm busy." And then I finally did get a date with her, and I asked her to come out to my house, my apartment that I then had, a Four Seasons apartment out in Vestavia. And I remember it very well because my mind was working. When I had this young thing out there, I said, I'm going to invite her out to my house, and we're going to go swimming, and then we are going to cook steaks, and we're going to have a drink or two or three or ten. And we're going to cook steaks. I'm going to ply her with enough booze. And are we going to have fun tonight? You want to know what happened? Good Southern Baptist girl. God have mercy. Anyway, she comes out and we go swimming. And I decided that the thing for this girl to have tonight is a martini. She'd never had a martini, so I was on about my fourth at this particular time, and the fire's getting ready, and I'm getting ready to cook the steaks, and I fix her martini, And she sits in the doorway, propped against the doorway with her, you know, feet against one end, back against the other like this, sits in the doorway, and I'm carrying on a conversation with her, and it is absolutely wonderful. I'm saying marvelous things, and I'm watching the fire and talking to her, and all of a sudden I turn around, she's asleep. She had two sips of that martini and went to sleep. Never try that again. If you're going to do anything with a Baptist, you got to have them sober. Oh, mercy. Well, I told you about meeting Sheila's mom and dad. Oh, God, what an experience. That lady fought me to the tooth and nail. A week before we were married, she was battling me, telling me that I was wrong for her daughter and that we shouldn't get married and that, God, the Baptist could never make it in the Episcopal Church. And we had a knockdown dragout about a week before we were married. But I want you to know something, that when we walked down that aisle, when Sheila and I walked down that aisle, after we had been married, we came out of the church and she greeted me at the door. And she said, "You are my son now, and I will love you." And I want to tell you that that lady loved me better than anybody ever has in my life. Sadie was her name. She loved me hard and well. And she took me as I was, you know, which is something I wouldn't have expected from a good Southern Baptist lady, but she took me as I was, a drunk, and she loved me. And she was very supportive of me when I got into the program. I say you can't take the Southern Baptists out of people. Sheila came into the Episcopal Church when we were married. She went through the confirmation class and she was confirmed. But I want you to know that once a Southern Baptist, always a Southern Baptist, she still refers to us as "you all." She never joined up. We moved to Cullman, Alabama. We'd been in Gadsden, and both of our girls had been born there, and I lasted about 2 years in Gadsden, that's all. And then we moved to Cullman, Alabama, and the drinking was getting worse. The extra stuff in my life was getting worse at this particular point. And, well, I'll tell you how bad it was. I've always felt as a people person, you know, and one of the things that I've always enjoyed most of about the ministry is calling on people and visiting with people. I just loved it. But what I always did as a good card-carrying member of this club, although I wasn't at that time, as a good card-carrying drunk, what I always did was visit people who drank. You know, I never called on anybody if they didn't drink. Gee, why mess up a good day? You know, I finally found an old guy in Cullman, Alabama. His name was Dr. Whiteside. He is now dead. Wonderful old guy, retired doctor, and he would serve me a martini at 11 a.m. I loved that guy. I would go to see him frequently. One of my favorite people. I went to see him almost every day. But it was getting worse. And then Sheila and I and our two girls decided to drive over to Nags Head, North Carolina, and meet my brother, who was also an Episcopal priest, is an Episcopal priest. He's 14 years younger than I am. And his family, and spend a week together. And so we arrived in Nags Head driving a borrowed van, and we arrived on a Saturday night, and I had in that van a half gallon of pop-off vodka, God. A quart of MacArthur's scotch, and the remains of a case of beer, probably about 12 or 13 cans. Saturday afternoon we arrived. Sunday night it was all gone. Monday I went to the liquor store again, and then again on Wednesday, I always got the same stuff. Half gallon of Popoff, quarter MacArthur scotch. You know, if you take Popoff vodka and top it off with a little MacArthur scotch, it tastes like Tanqueray. Did you know that? I learned all these things. Okay. And so this was the pattern for most of this week at the beach. And I was out walking on the beach one day. I was always pretty functional as a drunk. I'm sure I was blacking out a lot of the time, but you know, fairly functional. I didn't slur my words very much, and I didn't fall down. I just sort of kept it going all day and all night. And so about Thursday of that next week, my brother and I are out walking on the beach. Sheila has been talking to me about my drinking for all 5 years of our marriage up to this point. She even says to me at supper one night, she says, "Ed, you know, I don't mind if you drink. Why don't you just hold it down to a couple of drinks a night?" I said, "Wonderful idea. I can handle that. Iced tea glass this high, one cube of ice, vodka to here. It's still a fifth of liquor, any way you cut it. I could do that. Two drinks a night." I honored her request. Never remembered a thing. Always fell asleep in the chair watching the TV. Anyway, this particular day out on the beach, my brother, you know, all these other people who are saying to me, you know, you drink too much. You drink too much. You know how we are as alcoholics, though. We always find one thing that we do extremely well, don't we? Okay? To keep people from talking about our drinking. I was a great preacher, I thought. I said, well, I imagine I am a pretty good preacher. But anyway, I would work hard on sermons, never get drunk while I did that. Never get drunk while I did that. Go in there Sunday morning, deliver that sermon, do a great job with it, and go home and have five martinis. Don't bother me. Anyway, this day on the beach, my brother says to me, incidentally, he is also now in the program, but he says to me that day, he said, "Ed, you think you might have a drinking problem?" And, you know, who knows how higher power works in our lives? I don't know. But of all these people all over the years who'd said, "Ed, why don't you do something about this?" You know, why is it that I hear this guy this day? But I did. And when I heard him, I just sat down on the beach and sobbed and sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. And I said, "Yes, I really do have a problem." I was a basket case. I could not drive back to Alabama. My wife had to drive. Okay, it wasn't because I was drunk. It's just I was a basket case. I was so miserable, so sick and tired of being sick and tired. And we got back to Birmingham, and I stayed with a friend. I couldn't go back to Coleman. I said, I cannot go back to that town. So I stayed with a friend in Birmingham, and I called the bishop. God bless this bishop. And he said, "I'll get you some help." So he sent me the next day to a psychiatrist. I'll never forget this lady. Woman psychiatrist. So I went in and I talked to her, and I'm miserable, and I told her what was going on in my life, and I finally said to her when I got through sharing my tale of woe, and I said, "Doctor, am I an alcoholic?" You know what she said to me? God, wonderful words she threw to me. She says, "I'm not going to say you're an alcoholic. Let's just say you have an alcohol dependency problem. Now, what the hell is the difference? You know, ain't no difference. Oh, but it sounded like a great difference to me because I didn't like that word. I didn't like that word, alcoholic. And so I said to her, well, does this mean I should stop drinking? And she says, oh, God, no, don't stop now. She says, if you stop right now, you're going to see things crawling up the wall and, you know, all kinds of strange things are going to happen to you. Don't do that. Try to cut back. Try to cut back. So I went back to Coleman finally and I tried to cut back. Do you know how successful I was at that? But I could not forget that experience over in North Carolina, and I could not forget that I knew that I really had a problem. And so about the 10th of October, I decided that I was going to get some help. I must say to you that I had gone down, my wife and I, who were having marital problems at that particular time, had been sent by the bishop down to Miami, Florida, to see a bishop down there who was an expert in pastoral counseling. And while we were there, we talked about the alcohol, and he said, well, why don't you take a trip with me one day? And he took me over to the South Miami Hospital and showed me the treatment center. And I walked through that thing, and I said, God, there were a bunch of neat people in there. I mean, really neat people. I said, geez, if you're going to get something done about this problem, this is the place to go. And besides that, it's far away from town, and all those people that you don't think know that you're a drunk, they won't know what you're doing. So anyway, I went to see the bishop, and he said, I'll get you the help. And he called the other guy down there, and they got me a place in this treatment center. And so on October the 15th, which was a Sunday, I preached, and I resigned that same day. I preached, I resigned, I got on the airplane, I had four martinis between Birmingham and Miami, and got off the airplane and went into the treatment center, and I do mean this, I mean we all say it, but I do mean by the grace of God, I have not had a drink since then. Grace of God, because with all of my behavior over the past 13 years, damn, I should have been drinking. You know, I was just a dry drunk a lot of that time. But I loved that treatment center. That was one of the high experiences of my life. I really did learn a lot. And you see, as a high-class drunk, I had to learn about the disease in a way that I, as a college graduate, could understand. And so I saw all the films and all the other kinds of stuff, and I was in group meetings, and every night they took us to an AA meeting, but I just didn't think much about that. But I liked the rest of that stuff because it was feeding my sick head, you know, that I was getting fed my way. And so then I came back to Coleman, Alabama, and I had as my sponsor Father Hillary, and some of you have heard Hillary. I was telling somebody a few minutes ago that I was in the only group where there were more clergy than there were lay people. We had about 25 in that group in Coleman, and about 14 of us were clergy. 13 of them were of your brand, brother. And then there was me. There weren't any Baptists, though. Well, I got to tell you one quick story. I forgot to throw this in there. When it came time to quit, you know, I said I just got sick and tired. Have you all ever heard the ant story? You got to hear the ant story. It's a wonderful story. The ants are out in the field, and they decide that they're going to build a new home. The only thing is, where the head ant decides that the home ought to be is right where a big cow pile is. And so the head ant finally gets up on top of the cow pile and he says, which to us humans means nothing, but to those ants meant, guys, we've got to move this cow pile about 2 inches to the left. And so the ants get down and they push and they shove and they push and they shove, and after a while the head ant gets up on top of the cow pile again. And he looks around and he goes, which to us humans means nothing, but to those ants meant, guys, we still got to move it another little bit. And so they get down and they push and they shove and they push and they shove. And the head ant gets back up on top again and he looks around and he goes, which to us humans means nothing, but to those ants meant, guys, it's still got to be moved another inch or two. About this time, the littlest ant way back in the back, and he's panting, and he comes running up, and he gets up on top of that cow pile, and he goes, which to us humans means nothing, but to those ants men, guys, this shit's gone far enough. That's how it was for me on that beach that day, that it had gone far enough. Well, let me tell you about a little bit about the spiritual side of this program as I understand it. You know, I've always been involved in the church throughout my life. Always. Church has been important to me. God has been important to me. My higher power has been important to me, as I understood him, but I didn't understand him very well. I have to tell you that for a long, long time. I did know one thing, though, and it's a message that I still try to share with people every single day, that having a relationship with a higher power is good news, okay? And if it isn't good news, then get the hell out and go do something else. If it can't be good news, then do something else, okay? That's why it's called gospel, and that's what that means. It's good news. And if it's not helping your life, then find some place that is. And that's why we're here, okay? That's the spiritual heart of this program. Is that in here, it is good news. Okay? But you know, a strange thing has happened in the church, is that we've come to, you know, and I run into people every day who think this, and they say, you know, the church is for good people. Oh, what a crock that is. Okay? No wonder people stay away from the damn church if they think it's for good people. No, the church is just like this program. The church is for screwed up people like you and me. And the only difference between those of us who are in it and those of us who are out of it is that we know we're screwed up and we believe we have a power greater than ourselves that can restore us to sanity. The only difference. You know, and I hope, you know, this is my chance to preach, but, you know, I hope that, what did he say, is you find a community like that, that goes by the name of church. Okay? There's a lot of good stuff in there. If you can find a bunch of people who know they're screwed up. I think I've about convinced these folks up here at St. Simon's that they are. They certainly think I am. They most certainly think I am. God, I hope you can remember that. Church is for screwed up people. And then I had another great learning. I had a great learning that I would share with you, and it's, you know, I guess a lot of other people have known it for a long time before I have. And that's the difference between religion and spirituality. I finally am coming to an understanding of that after all of my 55, 60 years in the church, is the difference between religion and spirituality. Okay, because you see what religion is the structure. It's just like when we get together here in this place and you read the 12 steps and you read the 12 traditions. That's the structure. Okay, and you need it. You've got to have it. For where the rubber hits the road and where the good stuff happens is when we are in relationship with one another, because it's being in relationship with one another and reading the book and going, you know, being together, going to meetings, not drinking, that's where we have the spiritual experience. Okay? There's a hell of a lot of difference between that structure. You know, you can know all about your higher power because you can read about it all over the place. There's a big difference between knowing about your higher power and knowing your higher power. Knowing, you know, is a good old Hebrew word. To know in Hebrew meant to have sex with. Okay? It was an intimate word. Okay. And I'm so excited to finally discover, God, I've known everything about God for years and years and years. I learned Hebrew and I learned Greek. You want to hear my Hebrew? Oh, I've got to give you a little Hebrew. Shiroli awe kiga oga a su swarokavo ramavayam. Praise to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and the rider he has thrown into the sea. Song of Miriam. Are you impressed? Are you impressed? Okay. Jeez. The spiritual side of the program is the experience of your higher power. And I know, and the other thing I'm learning is that this is a trip that we're on. God, I've known this, I think, but it's coming clearer and clearer to me that, you know, this business of recovering and becoming sober is a lifelong job. It is a journey that we're on. You know, and the happiest people in this particular group or in the church, the happiest people are the people who buy into the trip. The unhappiest people are the ones who are looking for the pot at the end of the rainbow. Okay? If you buy into the trip, it's a wonderful experience. John Wooden, who was the great basketball coach at UCLA, somebody asked him, Coach, doesn't it mean a lot to you to train these kids to be national champions? And he says, that's not what I'm doing. He says, what I'm doing is to try and prepare these kids for the journey. For the journey. It's a marvelous trip we're on, my friends. It's a marvelous, marvelous trip. And if you want to have some fun, you just buy a ticket on the bus, which you've done. Otherwise, you wouldn't be in here. You've bought a ticket on the bus and the good stuff happens as you drive along. Okay, and it's a never-ending trip. It has lots of beginnings to it, but it has no end. And it's a wonderful, wonderful journey. Let's see if I have anything. Oh, I want to tell you one quick thing about humility. Did y'all know anything about humility? When I was recovering, I had been sober about 6 months. And I went back down to Miami to see this bishop again because the question was I eligible again to be a parish priest, which I really did want to be. And so I went back to see this bishop, and he put me through this battery of tests and did all kinds of personality inventories on me, and we got through. And I'd been working the program hard back in Coleman, Alabama, and I got there, got finished with these tests, and I went in to see this bishop, and I sat down, and he said, Ed, you're really doing well. He says, I think you're about ready to go back into the ministry. And I said, oh, Bishop, that's wonderful. Does that mean maybe I'm getting a little bit of humility? And he said, well, I wouldn't go so far as to say that. Humility, you know what humility is? Maybe that's what I'm talking about, the journey. The best definition of humility that I ever heard was, humility is always knowing you have more to learn. Humility is always knowing you have more to learn. You have been very gracious to me this morning. Following people like Babs and Clancy and Mary, you know, I kind of feel like the dog act following Marilyn Monroe. But you have been gracious to me on this Sunday morning, and I thank you for allowing me to share my story. I could not sleep very well last night. I was telling Bob that as we were having coffee before, that what happened as I lay down last night was that all of a sudden, and this is happening every day for me now, is that I'm getting recall on so many things that had just sort of dropped out of my life before, that I'd either hidden or forgotten or whatever, and I spent half the night recalling those things. Not all of it unpleasant, but a lot of it was. And so I come to you today tired, but so happy to be a part of this wonderful spiritual program. God bless you. Peace.